Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's May 18th, 2020, live to be rebroadcast May 20th, 2020. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine while live, you can comment below on Facebook Live. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND, as well as my my website, which is FranStorchND.com. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Okay, so now I'm going to go on a bit of a rant. You've heard rant on Ron's show, Bicycle Talk. Well, I have a rant today. And here it is. I hate the word lockdown. It's a word that's used in prisons when the inmates are locked into their cells and not permitted to leave for any reason. It's used to control the population, usually to prevent acute unrest. There was no country in the world where people were not permitted to leave their homes for any reason. Lockdown is a word that inspires fear and shame, and if you disobey the lockdown, you deserve shame and punishment. There are so many more catchphrases that give us more agency. Stay at home. Stay home, stay safe. Home safer, and on. At no point in the United States were we prevented from leaving our homes, going outside, accessing essential services such as going to the grocery store, hardware store, or to get gas. If you're on lockdown, you certainly can't go over and talk with your neighbor standing more than 6 feet apart with masks. You also can't deliver food to your elderly neighbor or, like Ron, deliver goods and services for businesses. You may say, it's just a word. No, this is a word that implies violence, fear, and shame. We have enough pain, sadness, anxiety, depression, and confusion. Let's reject words that divide us and embrace ones that bring us together. So I'm done with lockdown.
Right, I got that. I've heard that for a few days now.
Yeah,
that you're done with lockdown.
No, I just think, and it dramatizes the situation. Something that adds to the fear and shame and drama that's going on with the pandemic. I'm not saying that you should ignore the pandemic. You absolutely shouldn't. You should take this very seriously. People are getting very, very ill, and some people are on ventilators and some people are dying. So you should take it seriously. But what you should be doing is practicing physical distancing, not social distancing, but physical distancing. I'm accessing you socially right now. So that's one. This is a wonderful way to use technology for us to connect like this. You can talk to your neighbor who is at least 6 feet away from you. You can go out in public physically distanced. Of course, the less you do that, the less you are likely to encounter the virus and the less likely you are to become ill. So if you follow what you're supposed to do, you don't have to be locked down. I'm just not happy with that word. You know, washing your hands a lot helps. Wearing masks a lot helps. Staying out of situations where there are a lot of people helps. So let's see if we can reject that word lockdown and just use kinder words that mean stay at home. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear your masks, you know, follow the directions when you go into the grocery store, go to the grocery store, get in, get out, that kind of thing. All right. So now I'm going to talk about more controversial stuff. And here I want to engage about the doctors in Bakersfield. So some of you have heard about Judy Mikovits, and I did watch Judy Mikovits' video, and I think I watched part of Plandemic, and, I'm not sure I'm going to take that on. There's so much, and some people have done a really good job of responding to some of the claims that Judy Mikovits made. Some of the claims were just so hard to believe that I just find it hard to spend my time talking about them. Because, as I said, my job is to spend time talking to you, helping you to get what you need so that you can manage this pandemic, and helping you to stay safe and helping you to either not catch the virus, or if you catch the virus, catch it in as minimal a way as possible. And that's my basic job. You know, whether Judy Mikovits thinks that there are coronaviruses in the flu vaccine, that just seems really far-fetched. It's something I would have to research. It sounds sounds outlandish to me, and I just don't know if I want to take the time to research it. And there are a lot of other things she said which are interesting, which might be interesting to look into, but other, like I said, other people have done fact-checking on her, and if you're interested in looking at that fact-checking, I encourage you to do that. The Bakersfield doctors are another issue, because these two guys, and I'm going to say some controversial things, for example, I think these two guys were acting in good faith. Whether you should act on their information is another question. So I want to do what I think that a lot of people didn't do, which is as soon as they heard them, they rejected them because, again, they took them into this place of extreme drama. And I, you know, the drama doesn't help us. Drama doesn't help us. Hand washing helps us. Olive leaf helps us. Elderberry syrup helps us. Drama doesn't help us. Now, mind you, some of you are going to be go into a place of drama at times, and that's okay, because anything that you do to get through this pandemic is okay. And if you feel like you're in a place of drama sometimes, that's okay too. But drama doesn't ultimately help you to keep you safe from the virus, like, say, elderberry does, or olive leaf does, or, you know, thymoquinone from sesame seed oil, not sesame seed oil, from black cumin seed oil. All right. So anyway, so let's talk about these guys. So the Bakersfield doctors, their names are Dan Erickson, MD, and Artin Masihi, MD. They run a chain of urgent care facilities in Bakersfield, California. They conducted a press conference last month, I believe, that was intended for local viewing, and the conference went viral. I watched a second interview with them during which they stated that they had no intention of their conference becoming so widespread, but just wanted to report on what they were seeing clinically in their clinic and in their county, because they serve Kern County, which is where Bakersfield, California is. So they made some statements that caused some national outrage. So let's break down some of what they said. So here's what they said. They tested over 5,000 patients and found that 6.5% of the tests were positive for COVID-19, for SARS-CoV-2. They initially, for following all the federal guidelines, testing only symptomatic people, increased disinfecting in their clinics and using personal protective equipment. Eventually, they found themselves testing asymptomatic people who were coming in. They weren't seeking them out. They were coming in simply because they were concerned about exposure, or they were being sent by employers. So they would be concerned because they were about exposure because they were living with an elderly relative, or they thought they had been exposed to somebody, or their employers were sending them. So they felt that they had a random sample in and around Bakersfield, California. They extrapolated the data to estimate that 12% of California had already had COVID-19 with 1,400 deaths. That's 1,400 at that time, which was late April, which would mean a death rate of about 0.03%. From this, they suggest it's not necessary to keep the country in lockdown. That word I love, that this is a mortality similar to the flu. They also compared the death rates of Sweden versus Norway, which the first of which did not have a lockdown but urged physical distancing and protection of those at high risk, and the second, which did have a lockdown. There's some discussion of the accuracy of the doctor's statistics. The case fatality rate is actually 4 times higher than what they said in Sweden. So their statistics caused them to conclude that COVID-19 has a sickness and death rate comparable to influenza, in that the flu kills around 40 to 50,000 people per year in the U.S., and this virus has not reached that. But as of late April, 55,000 people had died in the U.S. because of the virus, and we're up around, what is it, 90,000 people right now? Yes, yep. Currently there have been more than 90,000 deaths attributed to COVID-19 so far this year, which is obviously more than in a flu season, and it's only May. I don't know if they're wearing masks during patient care, but if you look at the clinic's website, Accelerated Urgent Care for COVID-19 Testing, there is physical distancing and masking, but the doctors state that they don't think masks are necessary in the general public because if we are too sanitary, we will not be exposed to general pathogens and therefore develop immunity. So what's the problem with all this? All right. So the numbers in their data are representative of just one population base, one region in the state of California. So now we're going to get into some numbers, some population density numbers, which are kind of interesting. So in the state of California, Kern County, where Bakersfield is, Kern County has a population of around 900,000 people, and the industries are largely petroleum production and agriculture. It's not a very densely populated region. There's 100 people per square mile in the whole of Kern County. Bakersfield proper, the biggest city and the county seat of Kern County, has 2607 per square mile. So it's over 2,000 people, almost 3,000 people, 2607 people per square mile. Compare that to Los Angeles County, with 2,100 people per square mile. Los Angeles County has less people per square mile, but the city of Los Angeles has 7,544 per square mile. And New York City, the reason New York City had such a terrible time is it has an incredibly dense population. New York City proper has 26,403 people per square mile. The people just can't get away from each other. The whole of the state of New Jersey has only 1,211 per square mile. That's because you would think that it would have a higher population density overall, but there are parts of New Jersey where barely anybody lives, and people don't realize that. If you go down to the Pine Barrens, there are large swaths of land where nobody lives. The population is skewed nearer to New York City. So, for example, the city of Newark, New Jersey, which is New Jersey's most populous city, has 11,458 people per square mile. That's a little less than half of the density of New York City. So if you want to compare that to where we're sitting, Tallinn County, Connecticut, we're in Mansfield right now. Right. For comparison, Tallinn County, Connecticut has 372 people per square mile, which is more than Kern County. Mm-hmm. And Windham County has only 231 people per square mile. So these are the least populous counties in the state. So Fairfield County, which is our most populous county, has 1467 per square mile. Connecticut is not a super densely populated state, but most of the people are in Fairfield County. In case you're curious, like I was, the lowest population densities by county in the country are three counties in Alaska with 0.04 to 0.08 per square mile. And the lowest in the contiguous United States is Loving County, Texas, with 0.1 per square mile. So, you know, Alaska, in the top 10 lowest population densities in the country, there's about five or six counties in Alaska. And then there's a couple that are in Texas, because Texas has, again, huge swaths of land. And that county, Loving County, Texas, has maybe 134 people in it. And it's not on the Mexican border, but it's almost there. It's like not too far from El Paso, Texas, which is on the border. So anyway, Kern County has a relatively low population density, even compared to any county in Connecticut. This probably contributes to the low case rate. The only way we could have a fair comparison is to study case rate as a function of population density. Certainly in Connecticut, the state is going to be reopened at different rates based on region. We need lots more testing to find out where the virus is and where it isn't. Certainly the virus was so much more widespread in New York City because of the population density. All right. So comparing Sweden to anywhere, because everybody says, oh, look, Sweden didn't close down and they're doing okay. They sort of are and they sort of aren't. You know, they have issues. Sweden is going to have a higher case rate because they didn't have a lockdown. They may also reach herd immunity more quickly. Remember, lockdown doesn't mean you're not going to catch the virus. It means that we want to slow the spread so that hospitals aren't overwhelmed. Unless there is a vaccination, there is an expectation that we will all at some point catch this virus. Unfortunately, that is the expectation. But the way that we mitigate that is, even if you're hand washing and doing everything you're supposed to do, you do have a better chance of not catching it. That's what you're trying to do when you do the hand washing and gargling and nasal cleansing and taking supplements and being healthier and all the things that you're doing. You're hoping that you're not going to catch it, but you still might, you know, even if you take supplements and stuff, if you get somewhere where you're around the virus and you get enough dose and you spend enough time, you still could catch it. You might get a lesser case of it. And in fact, chances are you're going to have a not very serious case of it. That's, 80% of people do have mild symptoms or no symptoms. That's true. And then there are people who are more likely to have bad symptoms, and those are people who are older and have comorbidities, who have other other conditions that make it worse. Then there's the people there that are, and this is what I'm not sure of, and this is a statistic I'd really like to know about, which is there's the crapshoot people. And those are the people who appear to have, who appear to be, say, young, who have no comorbidities, who appear to be healthy, and they get sick and they get pretty serious disease. That is something that happens, and we don't know who those people are going to be. You don't know if you're going to be that person, because in my world, I'm seeing people who are older, who have some comorbidities, and they're doing just fine with the illness. And then once in a while, you see somebody who's young and has no comorbidities, and they get bad illness. And they may not go to the hospital, but they get very sick. And so you just don't know who that's going to be. So this is why they're working as fast as they can to find drugs that help the condition, to find things that you can do to help to mitigate the condition, and also to work on a vaccination. So if you compare COVID-19 to influenza, it's hard to compare because influenza rates are affected by vaccination rates and some degree of herd immunity. If there was no herd immunity to influenza, it's hard to say how many people would be gravely sickened and die with the current state of things. And you might see illness and death that's more similar to this high rate of illness with COVID-19. The reason we're getting so much illness with COVID-19 is because nobody's had it and there's no herd immunity, and there's very little herd immunity at this time, and there's nobody, there's no vaccination for it, and there's not a good drug that people can use. That's why so many people are getting sick. There's things that mitigate influenza right now. All right. So you could compare it to the Spanish flu in 1918 and 20, which spread very rapidly and killed over 50 million people worldwide. Medicine has changed since then, and yet we now know what to expect with influenza. COVID-19 also has some concerning mechanisms of action that don't appear to occur with influenza, such as the spike protein that directly bonds to lung, heart, and kidney tissue and increases coagulability, which causes blood clots and their sequelae, such as strokes, pulmonary embolisms, and pulmonary embolisms and tissue damage. There's also there's microcoagulations. There's tiny, tiny clots that we see that when they've done some autopsies on people who've died of COVID, they're finding that there are tiny blood clots that are clogging up various organs, for example, the liver. So there's a hypercoagulability piece to COVID, which I don't know that they see with influenza. So we're seeing these things. We have an idea of who will get gravely ill. That's the elderly, the immune compromised, the obese, people with cardiovascular disease and diabetes. Women fare better than men at all ages. The young fare better than the older. But there seem to be outliers with no apparent risk factors who get serious illness, and we don't know who those people will be. That's why it's likely we need to protect people with as much as possible with hygiene and stay at home. And at least physical distancing until we know more about this virus. We hope that soon there will be a number of pharmaceuticals known to help and also a vaccination. And I'm hoping, of course, that there's going to be some studies on natural medicine that are good, solid studies that will tell us what to do specifically with natural medicines, things like vitamin D and elderberry and hopefully olive leaf and curcumin. These things are going to be studied, whether they're studied in the United States or not. There are countries that value natural medicine more than we tend to in the United States, and studies will be done on some of these things in the coronavirus because we have these things at hand and they're easier to get. And the other thing you can do is if you're interested in looking at some good meta-analysis of natural medicine data, somebody to read is Chris Masterjohn, and we've been reading him. He's got some interesting data, and what he's doing, he's not doing research, he's doing meta-analysis, which means he's looking through all the data on various natural medicine, and he's compiling things for us. He's trying to look at good studies and tell you the difference between the studies, and that's very useful. So I'm very grateful to him for doing all that work. So in the meantime, I'm going to continue to promote hygiene, masking, limit travel, and I'm going to encourage supplements and foods that reasonably can be expected to protect against serious illness. Once again, I want to say the caveat, there is nothing right now, whether it's natural medicine, a food, or a lifestyle, or a drug, or a treatment that that I can say definitely will protect you from COVID-19. I want to make that disclaimer. There's nothing that we know of for sure. There's things that we can do that make sense, but there's nothing that we know of right now that's definitely going to protect you from the virus. So, you know, again, continue to distance, continue to wash your hands, continue to gargle and clean your nose, and take your supplements, and eat your good foods, and get your exercise. So there is a point with which I'd like to agree with the Bakersfield doctors. Although I think their premises merit further study, they discussed how they were shocked by the amount of anger and hatred directed at them. I mean, if you watch them speak, there are some people that you watch them speak and you wonder about their sanity or where they're coming from. They seem to be very dramatic. These two guys, when you see them speak, they seem like scientists to me. I didn't have an issue with them that way. And if you want to slam me for that, I'm sorry. But that was my observation. I think these two guys were acting in good faith. So I think that they didn't deserve anger and hatred and threats and all the other crazy things that happened to them. No one does. That whether you agree with them or not, in the videos I observed, the doctors were trying to present their experience in good faith. They stated that if institutions have an issue with their findings, they could question them and directly have a calm intellectual discussion about scientific methodology. Yes, I agree with that. Why not do that? If somebody says to you, let's do this, and if somebody gets up in your face and gets emotional and doesn't want to have a reasonable discussion with you, then you have to end the discussion because you're no longer talking about scientific facts. You're talking about, you're supporting somebody in their emotional state. And then that's a different conversation and that's a different kind of support. But unfortunately, people are so upset and so scared, and rightly so, between the virus itself and the astronomical response to it. People are responding in so many different ways, and very few people are responding with, I'm fine. I think if you're responding with, I'm absolutely fine, you must be in some way blessedly oblivious. But otherwise, if you're part of society and you are part of a caring culture, you're going to have some issues with this. You know, I am not in a place where I am not having issues with this. I'm a naturopathic physician. I'm not what you would call a sort of a calm person overall.
I can reinforce that.
Not particularly an introvert. And things worry me, you know. I'm worried about my friends and loved ones suffering, my friends and loved ones dying, myself suffering and dying. I'm worried about that. I'm worried about the financial state of many people in the United States. This has had a devastating financial impact on people. And so I feel a lot of compassion for a lot of people, and it doesn't end. It's not like it was a hurricane that happened and now we're picking up the pieces, or even 9/11, which was one attack and then we were picking up the pieces. This is something that keeps going. The virus is out there and you don't know where it is and when it is, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's gut-wrenching, and it's the only thing you can do is take breaks from it because it's always there. You know, you can't turn around and not be reminded of it. If you go out in public, you're going to be wearing a mask. We went out on our bike rides today, and I wear a neck gaiter during my bike rides so that when we pass groups of people where it's hard to physically distance, I pull the mask up. So, I mean, I have to be thinking about it all the time. Even if we're going on a bike ride where the only place we're not going to be distance is our rest stops, you have to carry a mask with you. So you have to be thinking about these things all the time. Anyway, what was interesting is that the right-wing media held up the Bakersfield doctors and lauded their findings, and the American Academy of Emergency Medicine accused them of having a profit motive since they have a lower census in patient visits during the pandemic. They were both placed on a pedestal and at best became targets of sarcastic remarks and at worst vilified. Their data was clearly not peer-reviewed, but they appeared to be open to having it reviewed. This is just one study. Don't be reckless with reopening and see if it can be replicated. It can't be without testing. But this further demonstrated to me how much we have become addicted to drama in this country, headed up by the lead player in the White House. The mainstream media presents the most extreme cases and scenarios, and we still don't have basic data on who has this virus and how bad. I feel like I'm spitting in the wind, but could we all please calm down and listen to one another? I'm not sure if I made this clear. Oh, yeah. Okay, here we go. My biggest contention is that Kern County has a relatively low population density, and that makes it difficult to compare to anywhere with a higher density. That's why I say there needs to be lots of testing everywhere at a percentage that is considered to be reflective of the general population, and infection rates, symptomology rates, and death rates need to be calculated as a function of population density. So for them to extrapolate, I think they did make a statement where they said less than a percentage point of people are dying and very few people are getting sick with this. You know, less than 1% are getting sick with this, like really sick enough to go into the hospital. So therefore, physical distancing and masking isn't necessary. I didn't agree with that because, again, Kern County has a population density of 100 people per square feet. And the county I'm sitting in is 372 people per square feet, which is not a lot of people, which doesn't mean that I'm not going to be careful. I am, you know, I'm still going to be physically distancing until there's a big consensus that it's time to relax. I'm not going to relax. I'm going to take extra care. We're physically distancing. We're not seeing our friends a lot. If we do see them, we see very few of them at a time and at least 6 feet apart, which we can do because we live out in the country. And, you know, we're continuing to mask. We're trying to make few trips to the grocery store. You know, in my practice, I see very few people in person. And of course, when we do, we mask and we have extensive cleaning practices. And, you know, I'm encouraging people to mostly do telehealth, and I'm very grateful that people do want to do telehealth.
That's great.
We're doing extensive cleaning in my office. You know, we're at least every hour we're going around and doing the cleaning every hour at least. And also anytime a patient comes in, we're wiping down. After each patient comes into my office, I'm cleaning, I'm bleaching, I'm spraying down, I'm opening the windows, all kinds of stuff like that. And my patients and I are both wearing masks. We're not letting people into my office without masking. And like I said, we're trying to push people towards telehealth, although we haven't forbidden in-person visits at this point. And like I said, very few people are even doing them. We're mostly doing telehealth. One of the things that you see in these times is something called confirmation bias. So confirmation bias, what it is you look for the studies that confirm what you believe. And the people who believe that we're taking this too lightly are going to look for, you know, they're going to look to Anthony Fauci and they're going to look to studies that say this is very dangerous. The virus hasn't peaked in Eastern Connecticut yet. They're going to look for things that confirm that. And then they're going to do more and they're going to stand up for what they believe in that way. And then the people who want the economy to be reopened, they're going to look towards the Bakersfield doctors. Problem is, you can be caught in a bind. There are some binds that people are caught in. You have people who can't afford to be out of work for long, long periods of time. You can also very concerned. At the same time, you can't afford to be out of work. You can also be very concerned that you're going to catch the virus. And then there are people who are essential workers who can't afford to be out of work, and then they're essential. So they work at a grocery store, they work in healthcare, they work in hospitals, they pick up your trash. They do a lot of the things that make it so that the middle class and higher can continue to stay home. They may be very scared about getting the virus and doing everything that they're supposed to do, but they're at risk. So there are people who are caught in those kinds of binds. It's a really, really hard situation right now. So there are people who are arguing about how you should take these incredible restrictive measures. And there are people who are arguing that we don't need to, that we can support ourselves, and that if we were healthier, we wouldn't get that sick. everybody is a little bit right. My bias is that I want to err on the side of caution. I am not going to, the idea that some people say that if you don't wear masks, you're going to be exposed to microflora more. You're going to be exposed to the microflora of the environment and you're going to have better immunity. They have a point. If you spend time outside, if you spend time digging in the dirt, you're going to be exposed to homeostatic soil organisms. You are going to be exposed to more things in the environment, and you are going to be able to build greater immunity. The problem is this is a novel virus that can get you very sick, and we don't know who the people are going to be who are going to get extreme illness. So you can't take that chance. Playing in the dirt is one thing, and you should certainly go play in the dirt, but you should still wear a mask when you're around other people. You should still take care of your immune system. That's still very important to do. So beware of confirmation bias. And my advice is to err on the side of caution and take as much caution as you can. Take as many precautions as you can. If you are an essential worker, obviously wear a mask, wash your hands a lot, change your clothes as soon as you come home, do things to mitigate your risk. But know that the virus is out there. I hate to say this, but the virus is out there and it could come to get you, unfortunately.
Sad.
Having said that, it doesn't mean that you have to stop living your life, because, you know, it's kind of like in that book, The Road Less Traveled. The first sentence in The Road Less Traveled is life is suffering. So once you realize that life is suffering, you can go on. If you're in life, there are going to be things that are hard. There's nothing you can do about it. So you don't have to stop living your life. And yet, take all the precautions. There's another great saying, which is, praise Allah and tie your camel.
Exactly.
Yeah. I didn't make that up. Okay. All it means is that you should praise God and know that God is there for you. If you not everybody believes in God, which is fine. But if you believe in God, pray to God, connect with your spirituality, believe in spirituality, and also do basic things to take care of yourself, like tie your camel up or tie your horse up or lock your house or wash your hands and wear a mask.
Right.
Yeah.
There you go.
Do the basic precautions in the real world. If you believe in God, one of the things that God taught us to do is think. And one of the things that God gave us was a brain. And one of the reasons you were given a brain was to figure stuff out. So, you know, God doesn't necessarily intervene in a way where God tells you, do this, do that, do the other thing. God gave you a brain so you could figure that stuff out. And then when you have outcomes that are favorable, then you might want to continue doing that stuff. But you know, be in spirit, connect, do your yoga. Connect with spirituality, meditate, do all of those things, but also be smart and wash your hands. That being smart and doing and meditating are not mutually exclusive, by the way. By the way, having a spiritual path and praying to God and meditating and doing things like that can help to protect your immune system, because they lower cortisol, and you have less cortisol, your immune system is going to be more readily available to fight any kind of illness. So, I can see on Facebook Live, there's some people who are on right now. So I wanted to say shout out to Paula, shout out to Sharon, and thank you for listening. And I want to shout out to Peggy. Thank you so much for listening. All right. And watching.
And Laura Smith's out there, Cindy Rip or Cindy Barassa's out there.
Hi, Cindy.
And Jeff Schaefer, who is, believe it or not, someone I went to high school with.
Okay.
How about that?
That's great.
Hi, Jeff.
All right. So here's another way to get great probiotics. Sourdough bread. So sourdough is all the rage. So this is something that'll be a little bit lighter. Let's talk about sourdough, okay? Because sourdough is, you know, so many people are making sourdough, selling sourdough. I am not making sourdough. There are certain things that because I'm still working and I'm working and, you know, and I have, my brain is going all the time. And one of the things I do is when I'm sitting down to relax, this tablet that you see me on, I open it up and I get my, my updates and my science and my studies and I read them. And so, to put myself, I haven't really done anything different. Like some people are taking up a new hobby or a new craft or, you know, building something. This one is building us drawers and redoing the house, but he's not also running a business. And I feel like I have to keep on top of the business. So when I'm not doing that, I'm lying around. Really. I'm doing more lying around than I've done in a long time. And I'm also riding my bike, you know. So I did so big shout out to the fearless women on Zwift this morning, especially to Winter Powell, who led the ride. It was the Fearless Recovery ride. And I'd been on my bike outdoors all weekend, so I wanted to do a nice indoor. I was planning to go outside this morning, but weather didn't cooperate. The roads were wet. So I said, I'm going to go with the Fearless ladies. And it was awesome. And what's beautiful about going on Zwift, I must say, is that you're on the bike and you can see women, you can see people. And this happened to be a women's ride. So you can see women from all over the world. And so I got some interesting stuff. And we were talking about how various places were opening up in the U.S. There was a woman who was riding with us from Poland. And Poland, if you go outside, you must wear a mask at all times. We're not talking, you know, here,
right.
You know, if we're outside, we don't have to wear a mask. We don't, I mean, when we go on our bike rides, we don't have to wear a mask, but no. I choose to.
Some people do.
That's right. And I choose to, if I'm going to be in an area where I'm passing a lot of people, then I definitely choose to wear that mask. So in Poland, they can go outside and exercise from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. and that's it. And they have to wear masks outdoors all the time. So it was interesting to see where other places in the world are doing things differently and various states are doing things differently. Winter is from Atlanta. So, of course, Georgia's open now and they're opening things up in Georgia. So
yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
I know.
It's going to be interesting. I mean, we're all kind of in a giant experiment.
That's
here.
Right. Well, and one of the things, too, is that if we open up and you don't feel comfortable doing stuff, you don't have to. You can still continue to stay home and physically distance.
Right.
I mean, obviously, it all depends on what your financial situation is and also, you know, what your ability to not work is, depending on how you're working. And if you are able to work from home and if you're able to work in such a way that allows you to physically distance, you can continue to do that. Twitter, the CEO of Twitter told people that once the economy opens up again and they're allowed to come back to work, that if Twitter workers who are now working from home want to continue to work from home indefinitely, that they can. There's no reason for them to come in if they don't want to. So a lot of companies are probably going to be looking at that. All right, let's get back to sourdough. So yes. Sourdough.
What's with sourdough?
Well, okay.
Why is everybody so like hyped up on sourdough?
Okay, the way you're saying that, it sounds like you have an issue with sourdough. Please talk about your issue. What's the problem?
I don't have an issue with sourdough. It's just like everyone seems to have latched on to this sourdough thing, and there's whole wheat and there's rye and there's pumpernickel and there's all sorts of different breads out there. But for some reason sourdough is the key player. And that's what I'm you know, ranting about, if I could be ranting.
It's a good point. Why? It's interesting. People have latched on to that. I mean, if you like sourdough tastes really good. So, and I'm somebody who I generally avoid gluten. I don't make antibodies to gluten like we think you do. So I am actually eating whole wheat sourdough. I don't eat gluten in general. I avoid gluten most of the time, but I've made an exception for whole wheat sourdough and the occasional baklava. Very occasional. I mean, we're only going to be eating Basim, Ifat's baklava as well as Christian's, and that's it. Otherwise, I don't eat gluten. But I have been eating sourdough, and I've been doing all right with it. And it's recently risen in popularity. I think just because it's a fun thing you can make at home, it's probably not too hard to make. It may not, I don't know. It's not too easy to make. I just don't feel like I'm in a place where I can go there. Again, one of my difficulties is I'm having a hard time doing things other than getting from day to day with all the things that I have to do, because I'm just very, I'm anxious about the pandemic, and I'm I'm making sure that I've got all of the information that I need to get and, you know, studying up on the information because it changes day to day. It's a lot to keep up with. So for me to start a project and make sourdough, it's hard for me, especially when one of the issues is shopping. Shopping is an issue. If we want to go to the Willimantic Food Co-op, we have to order our stuff and wait a few days before we get it. Going to the supermarket, you want to avoid going to the supermarket all the time, and you can't always get everything that you want. So shopping, which used to be a thing that, you know, I enjoyed, is now fraught. It's not something I do with the same kind of pleasure. It's something I do because I have to, and I try to avoid it. So going and getting stuff and setting myself up with stuff I need to do something new is a difficult thing. It's more difficult. Not that I wouldn't do it, but, you know, so that's why I haven't been making the sourdough. I've been letting a friend make the sourdough, and, you know, she makes beautiful sourdough, and we pay her for it, and it's great. So that's my contribution to the sourdough economy. So this is funny that I'm reading this sentence. Sourdough bread is an old favorite that has recently risen in popularity.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, bump. Yeah,
so a lot of people like it better than conventional bread. Some say it's even easier to digest and less likely to spike your blood sugar. And that may be true because there is fermentation that goes on. There's a starter and there is fermentation. When you eat sourdough, it has a tang to it. And the reason that it has a tang is because it has probiotics in it that are actually making lactic acid. So that's why it's got that slightly tangy, cheesy taste to it, even if there's no dairy in it. Is there any truth to the claims that it's easier to digest? It's one of the oldest forms of grain fermentation. It's believed to have originated in ancient Egypt around 1500 BC, and it was the customary form of bread leavening until baker's yeast replaced it. So people used to leaven with probiotic instead of like, you know, baker's yeast.
So that would be better, wouldn't it? Especially if you're trying to...
Well, if there's a variety of probiotic in the sourdough starter, yes, that's going to be better than just using baker's yeast, for sure.
System, right?
Well, you're going to get more variety of organisms. Okay. And if you have more variety of organisms in the bread and in the starter, you're going to get more variety of compounds that the probiotics make. So you're going to have generally more health benefits that way. Also, the probiotics will break down some of the starches and sugars, so it's going to be easier to digest. So, because leavened bread, most leavened breads you get at the grocery store, they use commercial baker's yeast. And so sourdough relies on wild yeast and lactic acid bacteria. So lactic acid bacteria is going to be lactobacillus. It's going to be probiotic bacteria. And they're naturally present in the flour. Also, wild yeast is more resistant to acidic conditions than baker's yeast. So it can work together with lactic acid producing bacteria. So that's the interesting thing. Acids are going to kill baker's yeast more readily. Wild yeast that's in the environment has learned to live in symbiosis with lactobacillus. So you have more variety of probiotic in the sourdough. So lactic acid bacteria are in other fermented foods like yogurt, kefir, pickles, sauerkraut, kimchi. So you get this wild yeast and lactic acid, it's mixed with the bacteria, lactic acid bacteria, then flour and water, and then you get a sourdough bread starter. And during the bread making process, the starter ferments the sugars in the dough, which helps the bread rise and gives it its characteristic taste. So lactic acid has that characteristic sharp taste. It's what gives various cheeses their profile. That's why there's that tangy, cheesy taste in sourdough bread. It takes a lot longer to ferment and rise than other kinds of bread, and it has a special texture to it. It's still popular in the Mediterranean and the Middle East, but also in Greater San Francisco. And I have to say, in Greater Mansfield.
Okay.
People are making a lot of sourdough.
There's,
I mean, when you look at the
sourdough,
a lot of sourdough happening. So some sourdoughs that you can buy at the store are not made using the traditional methods, so they're not going to be as healthy for you. So if you get it from you know, an artisan baker from a farmer's market, you're going to be more likely to get real sourdough. And that's why you should look at the sourdough to see if there's real starter in it and see how healthful it is for you. Right. So the other thing, so Peggy, thank you for that. Peggy says that yeast is hard to find. So sourdough, you don't need to go buy yeast from the store because you get the yeast from the environment. That's the other thing that's going on. But people who are baking are having a difficult time finding yeast. Yes. So the nutrition composition of sourdough bread depends on the kind of flour that you use, whether you use whole grain or refined. And a lot of people are making good whole wheat sourdough. So the nutrition profile is similar to other breads. A slice of bread, it says the calories on a slice of bread. That's going to depend on how big you cut the slice, obviously. If you cut a thick slice, it's going to be 100. How many calories there are in sourdough is kind of meaningless because it depends how big this piece is. But here's what you can get in sourdough bread. You're going to get a bunch of calories. A thin slice could be as little as 75 calories, and a thick slice could be as much as 160 calories. It's going to be somewhere in there, which means that the carbs are going to be somewhere between 15 to 32 carbs. Again, you can't really tell because it depends how thick you cut it. There's going to be a bunch of fiber, 2 to 4 grams, depending on how thick you cut it. There's going to be some protein, 6 grams of protein, a little bit of fat. You can get selenium, folate, thiamine, sodium, magnesium, niacin, and iron. Those are all going to be in your bread as well. Sourdough also has some properties that help it to be have an improved nutrition profile of other types of bread. Why would it be more nutritious? It's made from the same kind of flour, but the fermentation improves the nutrition profile because whole grain breads already contain a lot of minerals. They have potassium, they have phosphate, they have magnesium, zinc, but when you have regular bread, there's more phytic acid in it, phytates, and phytates bind minerals. They're considered anti-nutrients. They bind to minerals. So if you consume stuff with phytates in it, you're going to be less likely to get the benefit of the minerals. That's why we generally encourage you to soak nuts. If you're eating almonds, it's generally better if you soak them because you'll soak away some of the phytates and then you'll get the more benefit from the minerals. So the lactic acid bacteria in the sourdough lowers the bread's pH. It makes it more alkaline, which degrades the phytates. So the bread has lower phytate contents. So what this means is the minerals in the sourdough bread are going to be more bioavailable. This was studied and it showed that you could reduce fermentation could reduce the phytate content of bread by 24 to 50% more than conventional yeast fermentation. So, like I said, you're going to increase your mineral absorption and the variety of minerals that you absorb. And you also are going to get more antioxidants in the sourdough bread. So that's very interesting. It's going to increase the folate levels, although vitamin E may be a bit reduced. And so you get vitamin E from other places. So if you're concerned about vitamin E in your sourdough, the woman who makes my sourdough, which is awesome, Anyway, she puts nuts and seeds in the sourdough. So you can get varieties that she'll put nuts and seeds into. So you get your vitamin E back. And if you want to get your vitamin E, eat other nuts and seeds. Eat flax seeds, chia seeds. And that way you don't have to worry about getting the E from the sourdough. Long fermentation helps improve the flavor and texture. And so some people who are not big on whole grain bread because they want that soft, chewy texture, they might be more likely to go for whole grain bread because sourdough is chewy. Yeah, so
there you go.
It's a nice thing. It tends to be easier to digest. So I avoid gluten in general. You won't see me going and generally getting bagels from the bagel shop or getting pastries that contain gluten in it. But I seem to be able to tolerate sourdough. There's a lot of prebiotic content. So there's going to be fructooligosaccharides. inulin, other non-digestible fibers that are going to feed your gut bacteria. And the thing is, if you don't have a problem with the gluten or any problem eating the sourdough, you're going to find your digestion works better. That you're going to have that nice high fiber digestive experience. Yeah. Pair that with a bunch of fruit and nuts and seeds and everything's going to be good. So consuming sourdough, if you're not severely gluten intolerant, consuming sourdough can actually help your gut health and help your digestion. The fermentation may also degrade gluten. So there's going to be less gluten in sourdough bread. Hmm. Yeah. So that's interesting too. Because the fermentation process reduces the amount of gluten. So again, if you're severely gluten intolerant, you're probably not going to be able to eat sourdough bread. Like I would not mm-hmm. give you whole wheat sourdough.
I won't eat it.
But I would give you gluten-free. No. I would give you gluten-free sourdough, which is a thing. Right. But for me, I'm doing okay with the sourdough that has gluten in it. Because I do okay with einkorn. Now, mind you, I don't tend to eat gluten every day, although when I have a loaf of sourdough around, I might have a little bit of sourdough every day. But otherwise, I'm very careful about how much gluten I eat and what gluten I eat. And like, I will eat it in the form of einkorn because I do fine with it. I had einkorn pasta on Friday and I am eating the sourdough. I'm doing okay with it. Sourdough fermentation, as we said, texture and taste and nutrient ability. So if you can do sourdough with gluten-free bread, that may be something we want to try, is make gluten-free sourdough.
Okay.
Because, you know, what do you think of the texture of gluten-free bread?
It's getting better.
Yes.
It used to be.
It's certainly better than it used to be.
It definitely had some in its early days, it was like chewing on cardboard.
And it was crumbly.
Yeah, it was very crumbly.
And now they seem to have figured out how to make it less crumbly.
They figured out a better way to glue it together.
Yes, exactly.
It seemed a little better. But yeah, that was a problem.
Right. So, if you think your sourdough is a completely gluten-free, don't. It's not. So if you're severely gluten intolerant or you have celiac disease, you shouldn't do sourdough that's made from wheat. If you have a starter for sourdough, it needs to be a gluten-free sourdough starter. And if you're going to make a gluten-free sourdough bread. But that is definitely something you can do, and it might be a way to improve the condition of a gluten-free bread if you want to try to make gluten-free sourdough. So, also blood sugar control. So if you're trying to lose fat, sourdough might be a way to do it. If you like to eat bread, but you don't want to eat too much of it because you're trying to lose weight, you might be able to include sourdough as one of the things that you eat. It has a better effect on blood sugar and insulin than other kinds of bread, and they don't entirely know why. It may be because the sourdough actually changes the conformation of the carbohydrate molecules, which lowers the glycemic index. So you get a slower release of the sugars. And, when I eat a piece of sourdough, I don't feel the same way as when I eat pastry, which has a lot more sugar in it. It definitely, I just feel like I had something to eat and I feel pretty good. So the glycemic index is a measure of how a food affects your blood sugar. And it has a lower glycemic index, it doesn't raise your blood sugar as quickly. Also, those nice lactic acid bacteria that are in the dough produce organic acids. And those organic acids are going to help to delay stomach emptying. So you're going to feel more full and you're going to have less of a spike in blood sugar. And that's how vinegar works too. So sourdough fermentation is often used to make rye bread, and rye doesn't contain enough gluten for baker's yeast to work effectively. So usually when you get rye bread, there's some sourdough in it. So participants who regularly consume rye bread have a lower spike in insulin levels than those who have conventional wheat bread. The other studies compared participants' glucose response after eating sourdough, and those who eat it have a lower blood sugar and insulin response. So that's nice. So how you make a sourdough is there's videos online. You have to feed your starter daily. You mix your starter with flour and water. I'm not going to go into that because this is not my thing. If you have a great way to make sourdough, please share your information. So this Facebook Live is going to be sitting on my Facebook page at FranStorchND. So if you have a great way to make sourdough and you'd like to share it, you can go ahead and post that link there so people can learn to make their own sourdough. I wonder if Ron and I can talk about making a gluten-free sourdough together. Would you like to do that?
I will have to do some research.
Yeah, because then you're going to be all, what's all this about sourdough? And then we'll make you a gluten-free one and it'll be awesome. And you'll be like, oh.
Maybe.
Yeah. We should try it. It'll be because I haven't done a project, you know, because all I've been doing is riding my bike, exercising, nursing my sore knee when I exercise too much. Mm-hmm. And, working and not going to Florida. That's what I've been doing during the pandemic. So,
yeah. The damn panic.
I miss my mom. Mm. I really miss my mom. Mm. Okay. So, anyway, sourdough bread. And I also miss Nancy and Abraham and Harry Tally Marley. I miss them too.
I know. We got the whole
not going to get to see them.
Thing.
Yeah.
We drove to my sister's and stood there.
We did. And that was very nice. that was very good for her birthday.
It was a thing.
So it's a great alternative to conventional bread. The lower phytates make it more nutritious and easier to digest. A sourdough bread also seems less likely to spike your blood sugar. I think it's worth trying, and I think Ron and I should...
All right.
I really think that you and I should...
All right, we'll do some research.
Should try making sourdough.
I haven't made bread in a long time.
So,
I've never been a great, successful bread maker. So.
That's okay. Well, I think I'm going to go. You make good dinners, I must say.
I make good dinners.
You make really good dinners. Yes, we do. We're very blessed to have probably among the best greens in the world grown right here in Eastern Connecticut.
And they're growing like crazy right
they're
now.
They're really terrific. So yeah, we have beautiful salads with our wonderful greens, and we get the spinach, and we make our sag paneer.
Yeah.
Oh, we need some cheese curds.
Yeah, we need cheese curds.
Okay, so we'll go get some cheese curds. Yeah, we'll make cheese curds. All right. So I'm going to go. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching on Facebook Live. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave messages or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram, at FranStorchND. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back next week with more Radio Naturopath, right here at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.